The headlines: Iran says it is ready to cooperate with the IAEA to clear up the false perceptions regarding its nuclear activities. Hamas resistance movement reiterates that Palestinians will continue their struggle against the Israeli occupation until the final liberation of their land. And Kiev claims huge gains in its counteroffensive against Russian forces, while the Kremlin insists it will achieve its military goals. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran expresses its readiness to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency in order to clear up false accusations against its nuclear activities.
Iran is ready to cooperate with the IAEA to clear up the false and unreal images attributed to its peaceful nuclear activities. But we stress that cooperation with the IAEA is both in the sense of rights and in the sense of Iran's fundamental Islamic obligations. Just as it has obligations, it also has rights.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani also called for impartial implementation of the IAEA safeguards, stressing that the agency should not yield to Israeli pressure. This after a joint statement by France, Germany, and Britain raised doubts about Iran's sincerity and seeking a nuclear agreement. The Iranian spokesman rejected the allegations, saying the three European countries are under Israeli influence. He also described the anti-Iran statement as ill-advised and unconstructive. Russia says Iran's latest response to the EU draft text for the revival of the 2015 deal constitutes no serious obstacle to a final agreement. In a tweet, Moscow's envoy to the talks said the conclusion of the talks depends exclusively on the political will of the participating states. Iran and the U.S. have been corresponding indirectly over the EU proposal. The U.S. claims that Iran's reply was not constructive, while the EU says delivering Tehran-Washington positions have put the revival deal in danger. On Monday, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz alleged that Iran has not yet responded positively to the draft. Tehran, however, says it has not asked for any new demands or raised any issues that could be an obstacle to the agreement. Iran and other signatories to the deal, formerly known as JCPOA, are now awaiting a formal U.S. response. Washington left the deal in 2018. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says Palestinians will continue their struggle until they take back their rights and drive the occupiers out of their ancestral land. The group, in a statement, also highlighted the legitimacy of Palestinian resistance against Israeli atrocities. The statement was issued on the 17th anniversary, marking the regime's expulsion from the Gaza Strip. It also condemned Israel's cruel siege of the coastal strip and stressed that the Palestinian nation would not remain silent on the continued blockade. In 2005, Israel withdrew its forces from Gaza in what it called a separation plan. The regime, however, imposed a crippling blockade on the strip, potentially turning it into an open prison for nearly a million Palestinians. Gazans have repeatedly called on the international community to push for an end to the inhumane siege. Israel has launched a massive campaign of arrests in the occupied West Bank, detaining dozens of Palestinians since Sunday. The arrests have been made during raids in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Mona Kendall reports.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967.
So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise, and on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance, but for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Moving on to the war between Moscow and Kiev, the Ukrainian army claims it has retaken 500 square kilometers of territory from Russian forces in the south of the country in the past 2 weeks. The army says it has taken full control over several settlements in the Kherson region. Ukraine has also been claiming gains against the Russian military in the east. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country's forces had recaptured 6,000 square kilometers of territory from Russia this month. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has reiterated that it will achieve its goals of a military operation that it launched in Ukraine back in February. European economies have been left in the recession caused by tensions with Russia, rising energy prices. We discuss the issue in our news review program. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Tensions with Russia and rising energy prices are taking their toll on European economies, leaving some in a recession and others on the brink of recession. The UK economy grew more slowly than expected in July, raising the risk that it is already in a recession. The economy had already contracted by 0.1% in the second quarter. The UK inflation is at a 40-year high of more than 10%, prompting a cost-of-living crisis. The situation isn't much better in Europe's biggest economy. A leading think tank has warned that Germany will fall into recession next year as its economy is likely to shrink 0.3%. Inflation there is expected to hit above 8% this year and over 9% next year. Europe's economy is heavily reliant on Russian energy, particularly gas. Moscow has suspended gas deliveries to Europe, citing repairs and blaming the Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. European officials say Russia is using energy as a weapon. To discuss that further, we're joined by Max Civilli, who has traveled to Berlin, and he's joining us from there, and also Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Sweden. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with our correspondent Max, who has traveled all the way from Italy to Germany to see how the Europe's biggest economy is doing considering the situation. Give us an update, Max.
Well, there's growing concern in Germany about the energy situation. This despite the reassuring words of the German Chancellor Scholz. Basically, the Chancellor said a few days ago that Germany is prepared to handle a fallout of the crisis, energy crisis, should Russia halt its gas supply. Scholz said that Germany has put in place measures to counter the energy crisis, measures such as a regasification plant, which is being built in Wilhelmshaven in the north of the country, an infrastructure that will provide 7.5 million, billion cubic meters of gas, which is the equivalent of 8% of the total gas demand in Germany. But this has been disputed by the Association of Town and Municipalities, which is a very influential association here in Germany, which represents about 14,000 towns and municipalities across Germany, but also by a number of think tanks. There's fear of hacker attack. There's fear of an overload of the power grid that could create problems. Also, the think tanks, some think tanks have said that tens of thousands of businesses are at risk of going bankrupt. So the situation is very, very complex right now in Germany. There's also been moves to try to save 20% to slash, sorry, power usage by 20% by limiting heating and gas lights. So right now the situation is evolving, is changing, and it will depend very much on what the European Union will decide in the coming hours, in the coming days.
Exactly. So let's bring in Greg Simons from Sweden. Do you think that there will be any change in the policy of the EU regarding Russia, considering that they are paying quite a hefty toll because of the sanctions that they've imposed?
Well, I do not think there will be any change of policy. If there was to be a change of policy, the EU would have to be an independent sovereign organization that represented European interests. If anything, they have proven time and time again, and this is yet another proof, that they are prepared to sacrifice the rights and lives of European citizens to please American geostrategic imperatives.
Thank you very much. So, Max, back to you. Do you think, how will the public react, considering the fact that the situation is getting tougher and tougher?
Well, of course, I had the chance to have a stroll in the center of Berlin today and talk to the people from Berlin, and they don't really know much about the situation, about the dynamics behind the scene. What they know is that the main point of contention is the European Union, the European Commission's proposal to place a price cap on Russian gas supplies. That's a common thing they know, and so one of the most disputed thing, considering that some countries like Hungary, like Slovakia, like Austria, which are heavily reliant on Russian supply, have repeatedly warned that Russia could respond to a price cap by simply cutting off gas supply, and this is something that also President Putin has indicated in the past.
So, Mr. Simons, is it even possible for Europe not to be dependent on Russian energy?
In the short to medium term, no. I mean, both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates both stated that Europe is dependent on Russian energy. And I mean, they don't have any, any stake in this. They just pointed the obvious. I've heard the same thing in private conversations in Romania, that the more sober assessments in private, because what's said in private and what's said in public are two different things. In public, it's okay, save energy and hurt Putin. But what's said in private is that the system will not function. It'll start to collapse. and we can already see signs of this even before winter really sets in.
Thank you very much, Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Sweden, and also Max Civilli, our correspondent who has traveled from Italy to Germany, the European biggest economy, to give us updates there. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen.
The U.S. is hit by its largest ever strike of private sector nurses as some 15,000 healthcare workers join the walkout across Minnesota. The nurses are protesting hospital understaffing and demanding higher wages. They also are demanding better working conditions and higher wages. The strike is scheduled to last 3 days, and it will affect 16 hospitals. Negotiations have been going on for more than 5 months without reaching an agreement. The strike spotlights nationwide nursing shortages exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. This has not only put a heavy strain on workers, but also led patients not to receive adequate care. Strikes in the U.S. have occurred regularly over the past year. Employees are reporting to be exhausted by working during the COVID-19 pandemic and struggling with price rises. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Queen Elizabeth's death is seen by many as end of a person who for decades inflicted different forms of violence and brutality against world people, which included colonialism, racism, occupation, coups, etc. But unfortunately, we have to admit that the Queen's legacy will live on in the form of the violent and lasting rule that the royal family has overseen and still profits from. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the second part. The British Daily Guardian wrote this headline saying, "Condolences and condemnation. Indigenous people and people of color react to the death of Queen Elizabeth II. According to Guardian, for many, the Queen was the personification of British colonization and the damage it has wreaked in their countries, and they were not afraid to say so. In Australia, Professor Sandy Sullivan from Maguire University tweeting, as this week's host of Indigenous X attempt to explain their reaction and put it into a historical and social context, saying, for those saying we should be magnanimous about the passing of the Queen, a reminder that the Queen inserted it herself into the lives of Indigenous people here multiple times. She wasn't a bystander to the effects of colonization and colonialism. She was an architect of it. What she did do was be an active participant in stealing our land. Instead of handing back, making reparations from her enormous wealth, her agents that she had explicit control of, see the dismissal, continued to steal land, and when they had it all, they stole our children. Too many people fail to understand how inaction and the gathering of wealth is a fundamental in colonial incursion. For everyone saying she was a kindly grandmother, they fail to see that she had a job for decades that oversaw actions that made Indigenous people's lives worse. The website of Truth Out wrote, by design as much as by the accident of her long life, her presence as head of state and head of the Commonwealth, an association of Britain and its former colonies put a stolid traditional front over decades of violent upheaval, wrote Harvard University history professor Maya Jena for New York Times, adding, as such, the Queen helped obscure a bloody history of decolonization whose proportions and legacies have yet to be adequately acknowledged. For almost as long as the monarchy has existed, it had been a colonialist and imperialist power, colonizing and exploiting dozens upon dozens of countries and territories in particular in the global south, many of which share common consequences of poverty and continued oppression. Over centuries, the UK has funneled trillions of dollars from its colonies to enrich itself, and it continues to profit from its racist past and present to this day. The monarchy was built on slavery, establishing a slave trade that saw the transport of millions of Africans and South and North Americans to other countries. The slave trade was so vast, in fact, that it wasn't until 2015 that the country fully paid off its debts to slave owners from freeing the slaves in 19th century. Elizabeth, whose rule began in 1952, did not herself enact these policies, and she did do her small part to step in when, for instance, former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher refused to help end apartheid in South Africa. But others, like those who directly suffered under British imperialism during her time on the throne, say that she has had a direct impact on modern decision-making. Some historians may say it's unclear which of the UK-imposed horrors that occurred under her rule, like those in places like Kenya and Ireland, were authorized by her. Others argue that she bears responsibility that these atrocities happened to begin with. Similarly, this distance between the Crown and the country's political decisions often does not hold for victims of Britain's colonial rule that occurred under Elizabeth. The symbolism of her rule does not escape those on the left who argue that in modern days, the throne is a symbol of oppression, whiteness, and vast wealth inequality in the UK, even if mainstream members of the UK's left do not dare advocate for its abolishment. Elizabeth was at least partially directly responsible for some of the inequalities that the country saw and perpetuated while she was on the throne. In recent years, the Crown has resisted calls for reparations from countries like Barbados and Jamaica for their bloody and abominable exploitation in the British slave trade. The royal family's record of racism domestically over the past decades does not reflect well upon the crown either. These inequalities have been perpetuated within Buckingham Palace itself. Royal advisers banned coloured immigrants or foreigners from working in the palace until at least the late 1960s, over a decade into Elizabeth's reign. The family's deep-seated racism appears to persist today. In 2020, Duke and Duchess of Sussex Prince Harry and Meghan Markle outright left the royal family over racism within the family, despite protestations from family members like Prince William.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us ponder a wise saying from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him, on the wonders of faith in God Almighty. Anyone who acknowledges God should not complain when his earnings are delayed, and should not accuse God of what he has decreed.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, Ethics of Salam and Greeting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the ethics of saying salam and greeting each other when we see each other in the Islamic lifestyle. When we see the Islamic text, we see that there are specific ethics that when two groups or maybe two people are seeing each other, they meet each other, how they should say the greetings and who should say the greetings first, and what is the best thing to perform or do. In that, we see that the first thing, first ethic, is it is said that whenever two people see each other, and we see that there is a youngster meeting an oldest person, or maybe someone who is older in age, it is said that the smallest should say salam to the oldest. Young generation should say salam to the old generation. And therefore, we see that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, يُسَلِّمُ الصَّغِيرُ عَلَى الْكَبِيرُ. Whenever a small person, for example, like the one who's in age, smaller, he must say salam to the kabir, to the old age. وَالْمَارُ عَلَى الْقَاعِدِ. And the one who is passing from somewhere and he sees there's a group or someone who's sitting next to him, when he's passing from there, he should say salam to those who are sitting. وَالْقَلِيلُ عَلَى الْكَثِيرُ. And a small group, when they meet a great group, they must say salam to that big group. So this is from the ethics. The first ethic is that Imam Sadiq has said that the youngsters must say salam to the older, and the one who is passing or who is walking in the street and he sees that there is a group of people who are standing maybe, or there are some people are sitting, he must say salam to them. So inshallah, when we see our older, when we see our youngsters, even when we see people sitting in the mosque or the street, standing in the street or sitting somewhere. So when we pass, inshallah, we say salam. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the ethics of greeting and saying salam. We said that when a smaller sees a bigger, they must say salam. It means that if it's a younger, he should say salam to the oldest. If the person is walking, he should say to the ones who are sitting. If there is a small group, they should say salam to the big group. On the other hand, the second thing that we have is that we should say salam in a way that the other person can hear what we have said. And this is from the slogans of Islam, that the saying salam is the slogan of Islam, that the Muslims, when they meet each other, they say salam to each other. And they pray for each other when they see each other. So the second thing is that when we say salam, it should be in a way so that the person whom we said salam to him, he must hear what we have said. And we should say salam to everyone so that it is, because it is a slogan. The third thing in Islam is from the ethics is that we should answer people in a proper way. For example, if someone has come to us and said salam, even in a lower tone, we should meet him in a way with the energy so that he gets warmer or he gets a good feeling from our answer. So whenever we need to answer the one who has said salam, obviously it should be in a way so that they can hear us and they know that we have answered it. The fourth thing is that the answer of the salam should be equal to what they have said. For example, if someone says salam, you just say salam to him. If someone has said assalamu alaykum, you answer wa alaykum assalam. If someone has said salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, you must answer wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So the answer should be equal to what he has said. So the prayer that he has made for us, we must make the same prayers for them, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Colombia is known for its tourist attractions and is full of breathtaking natural sights such as beaches, mountains, deserts, and forests. The South American nation is also one of the few places that give tourists the chance to have an encounter with whales. Every year, from July to October, domestic and foreign tourists flock to Colombia's Pacific coast to catch a glimpse of humpback whales. The large animals reach the coast after traveling thousands of kilometers from Antarctica and southern Chile. But for visitors, there are strict rules to help preserve the area and the whales. Tourists are now being welcomed for whale watching after a two-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is also the time when humpback whales start their reproductive process. Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine an anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodiles seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations. A wide range of cutting-edge digital technology is grabbing the limelight at the
2022 China International Fair for Trade in Services, which is underway in Beijing. The exhibition is featuring a wide range of products, including artificial intelligence, virtual reality, metaverse, and 5G. Visitors can be seen taking virtual reality driving lessons and enjoying scenarios, including different road and weather conditions, wearing VR kits. It's the leading and largest comprehensive fair for trade and services in China. This year, an increasing number of traditional service companies are speeding up their transformations, resorting to smart technologies. The event has set up 9 thematic exhibitions, including cultural and tourism services, education and sports services, hygiene and health services, engineering, consulting, and environmental services. Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-coloured foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colours mixed by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food colouring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
Because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this... that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves its purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theatre.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Tehran Saray Gallery takes part in a massive art exhibition in South Korea, bringing Iran's leading and emerging artist to the Asian market. Works from 6 Iranian painters are displayed at the event, where hundreds of galleries account for more than $50 million in sales annually. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Seoul's annual global art exhibition has been reinvigorated this year with additional events and a most certain boost in attendance. The Korea International Art Fair continues an evolution that began with its launch back in 2002. This year features 164 galleries and more international exhibitors than ever before. That growing cosmopolitan experience and this region's growth as an art market hub is what brought a premier Iranian gallery to Seoul.
When we started this gallery, we had the big goal to just introduce Middle Eastern artists and Iranian artists to all over the world. So when you want to introduce artists, you cannot forget South Korea and Far East as well.
Sarai had participated in last year's art fair with paintings purchased by local Korean collectors. Expanding on that success at the event, and as Iranian artists are growing in international stature, Hassan Saradipour decided to display works from 6 Iranian artists at this year's event.
Our gallery focuses on the established and emerging artists. This artist, Abbas Nasashamlu, he just want to show that how the nature and how the human can affect to each other, how this experience, he can bring it on the canvas, on the paper.
The massive exhibition featured paintings, although there were various multimedia and sculpture installations. As South Korean living standards have risen, more people have time and money to spend on such events. Their taste in art has also become more sophisticated.
South Korea used to lack art galleries compared to other countries. There was a serious lack of love for this level of culture. However, now these events, I think, create opportunities for more people to gain such appreciation.
For the first time this year, Freeze Art Fair in Seoul exhibited works from 110 galleries, including Picasso, other 20th century masters, and contemporary talents. Frank Smith, Seoul.
An Iranian movie wins the grand prize for the best film in this year's Moscow International Film Festival. In its international debut, No Prior Appointment won the Best Film and the Best Actress awards. The movie is a product of Farabi Cinema Foundation and directed by Behruz Shoaibi in Iran in 2021. It is the story of a girl named Yasaman who returns to Iran from Germany after her father's death. A short stay in her father's hometown and meeting those who know him leads her to a new understanding of humans and the concept of death. The 44th edition of the Moscow International Film Festival was held this year from September 4 to 11. Animals, no matter pets or wild, are more vulnerable to drowning or dying in resulting floods and mudslides. A veterinarian school in Pakistan is offering free treatment for animals injured in the recent devastating floods. The veterinary surgery department of Sindh Agricultural University has set up a makeshift animal hospital as flooding hit humans and animals alike in the surrounding area. Volunteers have been providing anything from surgery to medicine and even ultrasounds to the animals free of cost. People from flood-affected areas can be seen bringing their farm animals such as goats, donkeys, buffaloes, and cows into the center. The worst floods in history have killed an estimated 800,000 farm animals. But there were many heartwarming videos trolling on social media showing people come to rescue animals being stuck hopelessly.
Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing tastes and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture. These days, computer technology is impacting every aspect of our life, providing a greater ability to place things, events, and people within context. An Iraqi museum has started using the technology and virtual reality headsets to make exhibits interactive and to bring scenes back to life. Visitors can explore heritage sites destroyed by terrorist groups. Now using thousands of photographs, a group of local engineers have given a virtual rebirth to five historic sites in Mosul and the broader Nineveh province. That includes a mosque and its leaning minaret. But this museum brings sites back to life for the people who live in Mosul. Although large parts of the old city remain oceans of debris, authorities are trying to restore historic sites, mosques and churches in Mosul. A private museum along the Tigris River, which opened in mid-June, saw more than 4,000 visitors in its first month.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Russian President Vladimir Putin has recently said Western countries are hurting everyone, including their own people. And he was right. Believe it or not, the world is going to be multipolar as world economies are exhausted by the US military and financial bullying. And when we talk about the US decline, we cannot avoid talking about de-dollarization and end of dollar hegemony in the world. So efforts are on the way to topple this hegemony. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the second part. According to Global Times, Putin said Russia is abandoning the use of the US dollar and British pound, as the US has undermined the foundation of world economic system and the two currencies have thus lost credibility. Russian natural gas producer Gazprom and Chinese oil major CNPC will shift to payments in rubles and yuan for gas supplies to China, TASS reported recently. Myanmar also announced recently that it is purchasing Russian oil products in rubles. Experts said the move by Russian and Chinese energy companies, when fully implemented, will remove a large chunk of international energy trade away from the dollar-based international payment system. Also, the current environment with the group of seven countries trying to cap the price of Russian oil exports and a temporary shift in global energy mix toward to fossil fuels. China's imports of Russian energy is set to see further growth. Jin Li, an associate professor with China University of Petroleum, told the Global Times recently. China is the top investor and biggest trading partner for the Russian Far East. In 2021, trade with the region grew by 28% to $14 billion, and 54 Chinese invested projects with a total investment of $14.7 billion were used in infrastructure, energy, agriculture, or sectors related to the Arctic shipping route. Alex Cao, a Chinese entrepreneur participating in the forum, said the EEF brings together the heads of almost all big Russian firms and is an important platform for his company to develop business ties with. On account of the increased financial cooperation between China and Russia under the current environment, he intends to seek to ink a number of financial agreements with Russian banks to fuel the development of his company, which is in the agriculture sector, Cao said. Bilateral financial cooperation has seen progress in recent months as the use of Chinese yuan continues to expand in Russia. Big Russian companies, including Russia's largest gold miner, PJSC Polyus, and Russian aluminum company, Ryusal have issued yuan-denominated bonds in the Russian market as Russian market players explore the yuan as an alternative to the US dollar and the euro. China's trade with Russia has surging 31.4% year-on-year from January to August to $117.2 billion in the dollar terms, data from China's General Administration of Customs showed recently. China's imports from Russia surged by 50.7% to reach $72.95 billion during the period. Russian Economic Development Minister Maxim Reshetnikov told reporters on the sidelines of the EEF that trade between the two countries is expected to reach an all-time high of $170 billion by the end of the year, on track to meet a stated goal of increasing trade turnover to $200 billion by 2024. The Russian minister added that these figures are confirmation of the joint work between Russia and China in many areas, including resolving export-import problems and ensuring the uninterrupted supply of goods and unhindered movement of goods through border checkpoints despite the current COVID restrictions. Many traders have abandoned the overland railway trade route due to uncertainty in the current environment, and as a result, the residential population of the small border city has declined by one quarter, Sun said. Also, RT reported recently that sanction pressure by some Western countries is spurring heightened demand for industrial capacity and said this could be a major opportunity for cooperation with China. The pressure by Western sanctions has forced Russia to ramp up its efforts to launch new factories and enterprises, said Eugenie Markin, executive director of the Russian-Chinese Business Council. Joint projects in the sphere of production of new plants and enterprises are among the most important areas, Markin told RT. A Russian foreign ministry official told media outlets in Moscow recently that Russia and China are exploring 79 deals that could amount to a total sum of $160 billion. The official said Russia welcomes investment from China, unlike the US, which treats such investment in a doubtful and hostile light. The EEF has seen the inking of over 150 deals worth 1.53 trillion rubles. China fielded the largest delegation to the forum with 205 representatives on site. And also, according to China Briefing, despite reports elsewhere to the contrary, Chinese Belt and Road Initiative investment into Russia has not dried up. It's just that it has flown under the radar or has not been officially notified. In fact, a plethora of new infrastructure investments have or are about to reach maturity, including in nuclear power, as well as other energy projects. The gas pricing of the planned Power of Siberia 2 pipeline via Mongolia has been agreed, now coming into development or online. Other important self-sufficiency related intent comes in that China has agreed with Gazprom, Russia's main gas provider, to pay for Russian gas in rubles and Chinese yuan, shutting the US dollar out of one of the largest ongoing energy transactions in the world.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the unprecedented and devastating floods in Pakistan and the resulting crises.